Today's show is brought to you by Five Nights in Vegas, a new romance by Elizabeth Stokes. It's about meeting, getting married, and falling in love in that order. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Scotch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. It is Valentine's Day weekend. We're going to be talking about some sexy films, or at least one sexy film. That would be 50 Shades of Grey. I know all of you are excited. You're dying to know what I think, what the fat guy thinks about 50 Shades of Grey. I'll also be talking about Kingsman, The Secret Service, The Sweet Blood of Jesus, and Still Alice. Plus, there's a listener recommendation for In Your Eyes, a Joss Whedon-written romance, and it's perfect for Valentine's Day weekend. But of course, before we get to that, we're going to be talking about some news. I'm going to be talking about Spider-Man and Marvel. Also, a little bit about Uma Thurman. What happened to her face? And don't complain to me that that's a sexist thing to say, because she looked freaky. There's also going to be the trailer park, some box office predictions, and of course, the world-famous DVD roundup. But before that, this is how you can get a hold of me. You can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. If you want to find me on the internet, you can go to fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. You can also go to twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
That's right, Ron Burgundy. Let's talk about the news. The big piece of news that sort of dominated the beginning of this week was the fact that Spider-Man will now appear in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Now, for those of you who are not swimming in details of Marvel and how it all breaks down, Marvel was originally just a separate company. That's a comic book company, and it sold its properties to different studios. It sold Spider-Man to Sony. It sold Fantastic Four and X-Men to Fox. Unlike DC, which is all owned by Warner Brothers, so Warner Brothers produces all those movies. So what ended up happening is Marvel Studios in 2008, for release in 2008, they started to develop the Avengers movies in this sort of Marvel Cinematic Universe. The ones that Marvel Studios was in charge of and not the ones that they sold off. And then Disney purchased Marvel and they got Marvel Studios. And for the longest time, over the last, better part of a decade, there's been an attempt to roll all these under one property so you can have them show up in movies together. And there's a little bit of a rumor that they're trying to develop a way to get Spider-Man into the Marvel Cinematic Universe, into the Avengers movies. And it finally came through. There is a lot of speculation and rumor, but the bottom line is we don't know exactly how Spider-Man's going to appear, but Spider-Man will now appear in the Avengers movies. A lot of people are saying Captain America 3 Civil War is going to be where you first see him. He'll probably show up in cameos elsewhere. They're also going to recast him. And Sony will continue making movies with him. Now, it's The Amazing Spider-Man and The Amazing Spider-Man 2 did well worldwide, but they've been kind of disappointments here in the States. And the second one just didn't gain the traction that they needed, especially for as much money as they spent on it. There's a big question on whether there's going to be an origin story again. Do we need to tell a Spider-Man origin story? I just hope they drop him in there. Everyone knows who Spider-Man is. Just recast. It's not going to be Andrew Garfield, although I thought he made a decent Spider-Man. So we'll see what happens. The bottom line is it's nice to see this all moving towards getting everybody back together, which is what they did in the comics. And that's kind of what makes the comics cool. And what made the Avengers so good is you had the crossovers, the cross-pollination of different movies teaming up together. At least now it seems to be what's helping. So we're going to look forward to that and hopefully not another Spider-Man origin story and hopefully a decent actor playing Spider-Man and not like Carrot Top or something like that. Oh God, did I just give somebody an idea? I hope not. The next piece of news I want to talk about is Uma Thurman's face. A couple months ago, we saw this happen with Renee Zellweger. She came out from kind of not being in hiding, but just being out of the public eye. And she shows up at an event. She looks totally different. And of course, the internet explodes with the questions of what happened to her face. And it's clear, it's cosmetic surgery. I hate this BS where the actual, they're just wearing different makeup. Their hair's different. I'm like, so different makeup in your hair can make you look like an entirely different person. Uma Thurman looks terrifying now. She looks like a China doll. And she's got this weird stretched out eyes that it's not, she used to have bigger eyes. Her eyes are very different and her face is, it's really pretty terrifying. Just Google search her. Obviously you can't see what she looks like on the radio, but here's a great example of cosmetic surgery looking terrible. And it's not there to make you feel better and be happier because the actresses are doing the same. They want to make them look better. By that mean they want to look younger, but they look alien, not younger. there's been a backlash to a backlash. We get this a lot. Backlashes to backlash. And the backlash to this backlash is, oh, we shouldn't question it. All it is calling attention to the fact that women need to do this. And if she wants to do it, she can do whatever she wants to. I'm not saying Uma Thurman can't do whatever she wants to her own face. That's true. But here's the thing. You're going on a red carpet. She showed up on a red carpet. The only reason to show up on the red carpet is to get your face and name out there in the spotlight. And she did. But if that's all you are, all red carpets are photo ops. And that's all it is what you look like. That is really all it is. And she did a movie just recently. She did Nymphomaniac, and she was in Movie 43 a couple years ago. So she looked normal. That she does. I mean, she looked older by a little bit compared to like Kill Bill or like way back in the early 90s when she was making films. But she looks different. And it reminds me when Kim Novak showed up in the Oscars and people freaked out. They said, oh my God, did you see what Kim Novak looked like? And she deflected it by responding, oh, it's bullying. And she's a person has a right to look as good as they can. And I feel better when I look better. The bottom line is, you don't look better. Who are telling these women that they look better with this plastic surgery? And guys, too. This is not just women. Because remember, what about Michael Jackson? What about Mickey Rourke? What about Nicolas Cage? John Travolta? Kenny Rogers? Wayne Newton? All these guys, sure, they're a little older when they've been getting this plastic surgery. But guys get bad plastic surgery and people point it out. I just watched the Mindy Project the other day. And Fred Grandy and Dan Hedaya were both on it playing older guys. And Dan Hedaya looked like he was wearing prosthetics. Fred Grandy, he'd aged, but he looks normal. But Dan Hedaya, there's this whole spot in his forehead that didn't move. So it's not just the women, it's the men too. And yeah, those guys are in their 70s. But the thing is, it doesn't look better. You're creating the Catherine Hellman character from Brazil and bringing it to life before our very eyes. It's a freaking horror show out there. If an auto body shop prepared your car with spackle and bubblegum, making it look nothing like the original version, you'd sue them out of existence. So why is it when a woman hits 40 that she feels like she's got to look like a bizarre China doll? This is a hideous thing people are doing. It's grotesque, and they're not doing it because they feel better. They're doing it because they want to look younger. But you know what? You're not going to. Plastic surgery may be the answer to some things, but not to this one. All right, that sound means we need to move on. It's time to talk about the trailer park really quick. The Magic Mike XXL had a trailer that dropped. It opens on July 1st. I'm not going to play because it's all music. But if you really want to see a good Magic Mike trailer, check the one that I'm in. Go to fatguysatthemovies.com. You'll see a post and get to watch me in my own Magic Mike triple XL trailer. But first, let's talk about Poltergeist, which opens on July 24th.
I can't find Maddie!
Madison!
We have to call somebody.
You can't call the cops.
What are you going to tell them?
First things first. Your daughter is here, and she's alive. This development was built on a cemetery. It's a poltergeist.
This is, of course, the remake of the 1982 thriller. Some people freak out when horror movies get PG-13 ratings. This actually was one of the movies that was responsible for it. Not just Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, not just Gremlins, but also Poltergeist, because there was a scene where this guy was tearing his face off. It was a pretty frightening movie, especially in the early 80s. This one looks okay. It looks a little overly CGI. My problem with CGI isn't its existence. It's when it's just used too much. And that's one of the things I like about what James Wan would do with his movies is while he has some CGI, he does a lot of practical and he does stuff that he doesn't need the CGI and some jump scares and some tricks of light and shadow. That actually is way more effective than CGI. But anyways, we'll see what happens with Poltergeist. It could be good. The trailer doesn't impress me. The next trailer I want to talk about is Trainwreck, starring Amy Schumer. It's a Judd Apatow film. It opens also on July 24th.
Before you judge, you should know I'm doing fine. My friends are awesome. My apartment's sick. And I have a great job at a men's magazine.
I like you, Amy. You're clever, but you're not too brainy. You're pretty-ish, and you're not gorgeous. You're approachable.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Oh my God, he's calling me.
Why would he call? You guys just had sex.
This is Amy. I think you butt-dialed me.
No, I dialed you with my fingers.
What'd she say? What'd she say?
Shh. He called me on purpose.
Hang up. He's obviously, like, sick or something.
I'm not terribly familiar with Amy Schumer. I know she had a show on Comedy Central. I'm not a big fan of Judd Apatow. He's really kind of grinding my gears now. But the fact that this is not something that he wrote might be a good thing. It might be a good thing that it's Amy Schumer's humor. That's hard to say. We've seen this story before about the woman who sleeps around because she's trying to find a guy, but her sort of relationship life is all skewed. It's nothing new, but it looks like it could be funny, and hopefully it's not just typical Judd Apatow crap. Or, as I like to say, Judd Crapatow. That's original. I'm sure he's never heard that before. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Kingsman, The Secret Service, and Still Alice.
Spider-Man, Spider-Man, does whatever a spider can. Spins a web any size, catches thieves just like guys. Look out!
There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Welcome back to Fat Guys in the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's roll on into the movie reviews. Let's talk about Kingsman, The Secret Service. This is directed by Matthew Vaughn. And what's interesting is I know he directed several movies. Probably the biggest one that's most well known is X-Men First Class, not the most recent one that came out, but the one before it. And he was, of course, involved in the new one that came out this last summer. Although it was directed by Bryan Singer, he helped produce it. I think he's helped write it. But Kingsman, The Secret Service is also based on a comic by the same writers who did Kick-Ass, which is another film Matthew Vaughn directed, which kind of got him the job to do the X-Men movie. So in Kingsman, The Secret Service, a young punk in England is recruited as a spy and must thwart a billionaire's attempt at global terrorism.
Huge IQ, great performance in the Marines, but you gave up. Drugs, petty crime, never had a job.
Who are you?
Your father saved my life. What do you see? I see potential. Kingsman is an international intelligence agency operating at the highest level of discretion. If you're prepared to adapt, you can transform
into a spy.
Interested?
Oh, yes.
There are some really cool things about Kingsman that make it very fun to watch, and it reminds me a lot of Kick-Ass in both good and bad ways. In a good way, because it has some crazy action. And it's got a lot of energy. It sort of has this, the same kind of energy you'd see in like a Guy Ritchie film or an Edgar Wright film. It really has some punch to it, no pun intended. The biggest problem that it has is it's one of those schizophrenic movies. And I once heard somebody complain about when critics say a movie is trying to be two things. And they say, well, why can't a movie be two things? And it's true. A movie can be two things. There are some movies that are wonderful romances and intense dramas. There's movies that are very, very funny that are also heartbreaking. You can have a movie do two different things. The problem is when a movie does two different things and it's kind of at odds with itself. And this is what happens in Kingsman: The Secret Service. We saw this in Kick-Ass 2, even though Matthew Vaughn just directed the first one. We saw this in the sequel to Kick-Ass. On one hand, the first half of Kingsman is sort of a punchy, hip, younger version of kind of a James Bond Jr. type movie. It has some pretty cool action. It has gadgets. It's got the whole spy technology. It's not overly stuffy, even though it's British. And even though you've got Colin Firth playing like one of the older spy gentlemen helping him out, it's not overdone in that sense. And in a way, it kind of reminds me, very different, but it kind of reminds me a little bit of what they did with Triple X. What was that, like 15 years ago that came out? When Vin Diesel starred in Triple X, it was sort of the Generation Y answer to the James Bond movies. It was higher octane, it was muscle cars, it wasn't all primped and tuxedos and shaken not stirred martinis. Kingsman: The Secret Service kind of does the same thing, where it's saying we're not being the old-fashioned James Bond movies. We're not James Bond from the 60s. We are James Bond now. And that works. And I kind of really got into that movie. Well, somewhere in the middle, I'll just say it's the scene that takes place in a church. The movie kind of turns and becomes a wackadoodle, over-the-top exercise in excess. Kind of like the movie Shoot 'Em Up, if you remember that 7 or 8 years ago with Clive Owen. And then it just goes over the top and it never comes down. And part of the problem is it sets up some interesting character things in the first half of the movie that are sort of squandered for crazy action. And I love crazy action, but I kind of would rather it to be that's what the movie's about, because it goes so far into this extreme that it sort of unravels a lot of the interest I had in the characters and the story that was set up initially. And that's my biggest problem with it. I mean, I thought it was a lot of fun. I mean, Samuel L. Jackson plays a villain, and Samuel L. Jackson has two types of performances. He has ones that he's like a real hardcore, serious dude, and we'll see him in everything from Pulp Fiction to The Negotiator in that kind of role. And then he has movies that he's playing kind of a caricature of himself, and this is what he does here. And it reminds me a little bit of how he was in the movie The Spirit, the one that was directed by Frank Miller. It was just way out there, and he was just ridiculous in this movie. Samuel L. Jackson does this a lot. It's kind of like what he played in RoboCop last year. It's not a great role, and it's almost too over the top. While I had fun watching Kingsman: The Secret Service, it didn't come together as a movie. I would have preferred one or the other, just because it changes gears in the middle and never goes back to what it should have been. But still, I'm going to say it kind of rocks, because it's kind of fun.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys in the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next film I want to talk about is Still Alice. This has been around for a while. It was one of the late entries into award season. It had a very, very, very limited run at the end of December in like New York and L.A., and then it started slowly coming out and roll out across the nation in January. Julianne Moore stars as an esteemed lecturer who develops early onset Alzheimer's and deteriorates quickly.
I need to talk to you. I got something wrong with me.
What's going on?
Oh boy.
He's gonna break up or?
No. I have Alzheimer's disease. Early onset.
Oh my God.
I can see the words hanging in front of me, and I can't reach them, and I don't know who I am, and I don't know what I'm going to lose next.
Now, a little bit of personal disclosure. My grandfather had Alzheimer's disease, and while it was not early onset, I think he was in his 70s by the time it kind of got full blown, it was kind of awful to watch him lose his mind. And he passed away in the 90s, early 90s, and so we kind of watched him go through this Alzheimer thing in the 80s, and that was 30 years ago. But that didn't make it. It's no easier now. It's still a rough disease to get through, because you take somebody who really knows what they're doing and they just start to lose their faculties. And it's sad and it's depressing and it's heartbreaking. And so often Hollywood has used it as a crass joke or a punchline just to do something silly. And Hollywood has rarely shown Alzheimer's to be the way Alzheimer's really is. And one of the things that I think is great about Still Alice is it actually, it's a really good realistic depiction of what happens. There are no easy answers, but that's the way Alzheimer's disease is. You still have the person around, but they're not all there. Sometimes they're there, but not always. And the other thing that's really fascinating about this movie is it shows simultaneously what it's like for the family to deal with this, but also what it's like for her to deal with this. We kind of get in her head. And that's important, because part of the terror I have of Alzheimer's for myself is you lose your mind. And you're still physically fine. It's just mentally you're not there. And I've seen this happen, and it's heartbreaking. And I think Julianne Moore does a fantastic job acting in this movie. She's probably going to win the Oscar for it, and she should. And overall, the performances are decent, even by Kristen Stewart. She doesn't phone it in the way she's done before, but she doesn't knock it out of the park either. But you got Alec Baldwin, and Alec Baldwin plays her husband, and it's a difficult role for him, because it's hard for him to be, his character's got to still be loving and supportive, but also you're seeing the burden that he's carrying. It's got a very good cast, and it's very well-meaning. It's heartbreaking, and it's not always easy to watch. But it's worth seeing. And I'll tell you, if a great viewing kind of 1-2 movie companion to watch this with is Glenn Campbell, I'll Be Me, which is about him actually suffering from Alzheimer's and watching him deteriorate throughout this documentary. That's very powerful as well. So, I mean, if you really want to get depressed, you can watch those two back to back. But Still Alice is a good, strong movie. It's definitely worth seeing. So check it out. Still Alice totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about some askew versions of love in 50 Shades of Grey and The Sweet Blood of Jesus.
It hurts.
Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies rolling at you. Let's talk about the big movie that everybody's talking about, starting a national conversation. I mean, people who don't even want to see this movie are talking about this movie. People from horny housewives to pious churchgoers who are literally trying to get people to sell or give back their books so they're not tempted by the naughty sex stuff that's going on in this movie. I am, of course, talking about 50 Shades of Grey. Now, if you don't know anything about this movie, how could you not? It's been in development for a year, and it's been nothing but headlines for the last month or two. This originally started as fan fiction for Twilight. It was made literally as Bella and Edward written out, and then it was moved off of a fan fiction site and put on the writer, E.L. James, her site, and then she got a publishing deal, and they just changed the names and changed the setting to make this movie. So basically, Christian Grey is Edward, and Anastasia Steele is Bella. The big catch is that she took out vampires and she put in sex. And not only is it sex, it's naughty sex. It's taboo sex. It's BDSM, which stands for bondage and dominance, sadism and masochism. That's what BDSM is. Let's just go ahead and play the trailer. A repressed woman starts a daring relationship with a controlling man as he introduces her to the world of S&M.
Mr. Grey will see you now. He was really smart, very intense. To what do you owe your success?
I've always been good at people. I have a natural instinct for what makes a person tick.
So you're a control freak?
I exercise control in all things.
It must be really boring.
My tastes are very singular. You wouldn't understand.
Enlighten me then.
The one thing that I thought when I left this movie, and I even said this to the rep and to other critics who loathed the film, I said, you know, I didn't hate it, which I'm sure is going to show up on the Blu-ray cover box. I didn't hate it, Kevin Carr, Fat Guys at the Movies. If you take this movie entirely for just what it is, and that being a horny housewife fantasy, as a piece of escapist fiction for a woman who is feeling like she's got a boring life and wants to read something titillating and naughty, it works. It's passable. It's not a great movie. It's poorly written. And it's painfully obvious it's a ripoff of Twilight. I mean, to the point there are scenes lifted right out of Twilight. There's a scene where Christian Grey stops Anastasia from walking into traffic and he grabs her and saves her life, which is exactly what happens in Twilight. The other thing that's hilarious about this movie, if you go to watch it, just look for, let's just call it symbolic genital placement in the background. You will see things more than you would if you watch Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. There is more symbolism for nether regions than you're going to see anywhere. Just look for it, and you'll be, like, stunned. You'll be just like, this is so heavy-handed. I'm also tired of looking at all the different shades of gray. And the use of color, which is very... It's like almost like watching I Know Who Killed Me, which nobody remembers. But if you've seen that, it overuses the symbolism of color. The thing that saves this movie is Dakota Johnson. She's actually very good in the movie. In fact, she would have made a great Bella. Kristen Stewart, I mean, as much as I probably would have hated the Twilight movies no matter who was in them, Kristen Stewart was so bad that it was impossible to watch by the end. And Robert Pattinson, he was pretty awful too. Jamie Dornan, who plays Christian Grey, he's terrible in this. I mean, he's bad. I mean, like, almost embarrassingly bad. He is so limp and lame and has no personality. There is no chemistry with him. And he constantly looks like he's ready to start to giggle, even though he's supposed to be playing dark and sinister. Dakota Johnson's what saves this. And kind of what I kind of liked about it, too, is she's very brave going, showing everything. She gets completely naked in the movie. But she's very normal looking. I mean, she's thin, she's small, but she's not overly muscle tone. Her breasts aren't fake. You know, she looks very natural, very normal. And I think that's good. I think we need more of that in Hollywood than the balloons under their chest look that you get in, like, you know, The Girls Next Door, that old TV show of the Playboy models. She's what makes the movie decent. And I got into her character and I liked her, and she wasn't as annoying as Bella. And there's at least a realism behind her. The biggest problem with this movie, though, is it completely gets BDSM wrong. And it gets kink and fetish and all this stuff completely wrong, because the way this stuff really works, the very 10,000 foot, I mean, if you want to go research it, tip it into Google, you'll figure out what it's about. But in this sort of lifestyle, there are people who like to be dominant and there are people who like to be submissive. They both should be into it, and they find each other's consenting adults. You don't go find somebody who's not into it and try and drag them in there, because that's just going to be an unmitigated disaster. Nah, that's not what the movie's about, really. I mean, the movie's more about the taboo and her getting the sexual awakening and sort of connecting with him. I guess that's what the movie's about. For what it is, it is. I mean, the sex is really boring. I mean, people are like, oh my gosh, isn't this terrifying? Oh, he's got a riding crop. I remember watching these scenes, and I'm sitting there, I was sandwiched between people from the morning news, and these look like they're 20-something girls who are terrified when the big fat guy in a leather coat sat next to them. And I'm watching it. When that was over, when the sex scenes were over, I'm like, that's it? That is what you consider naughty and daring? Trust me, spend an afternoon. I'm not even spend 20 minutes on an unfiltered image search on Google, and you will have your eyes fall out of your head. This is nothing compared to that. If you don't have very broad horizons, you're just some repressed housewife who's reading this because it gets you a charge. It works for what it is. That's why I kind of have to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
All right, the next movie I want to talk about is Da Sweet Blood of Jesus. And that is actually how it's pronounced. It's Da, D-A, Sweet Blood of Jesus. It's by Spike Lee. He took the Kickstarter to fund this remake of Ganja and Hess, the story of a man turned into a blood addict and his relationship with one of his victim's widows.
Dr. Green, if I may say so, you don't look that good.
Hess, I put a door!
Go away!
What are you?
I'm an addict. People have many addictions. Sex, food, drugs, nicotine, alcohol, money, power,
and blood.
I have never seen Ganja and Hess, but I have seen blaxploitation movies. And I've seen a lot of clips of Ganja and Hess. After I watched this, I went back and I tried to find the movie. I couldn't find it easily, quickly to watch online. And it's not exactly it. There aren't very many video stores around to find it. I eventually watched a bunch of clips and scenes from it, and it is definitely a remake of that. But there's something organic about 70s low-budget filmmaking that is kind of lost in some filmmaking today. There's an organic feel to the film. There's a natural feel to everything. And in this movie in particular, because it deals with racial issues and it deals with the African-American experience and the whole blood addict and the vampirism angle to it is meant to be symbolic of the struggles that African-Americans go through. The things that were used as symbols and talking pieces and some of the tropes that were used in the early 70s would be considered really racist and terrifying now. I mean, there was a lot of tribal imagery back then, and you can find that in the original movie. There's a taboo for the sex, which is a little more mundane now. And I mean, Spike Lee adds a couple things in there, like, you know, of course, being a blood addict and drinking the blood of others. He throws in some AIDS references. He works a little bit outside of his comfort zone, and that's kind of cool. But overall, the movie just never really gets charged up. And I think it loses some of its grittiness and organic feel by being shot on digital video in a much more sterile environment than what you had back in the 70s. And it's just not as daring, because the stuff that's happening in the movie, while it is a little bit shocking, I mean, especially if you're the kind of person who thought 50 Shades of Grey was horrifying and terrifying and oh, so much sex, you would probably freak out at some of the sex in Sweet Blood of Jesus. But to just, you know, a film goer who's used to watching underground films, it's pretty tame. It has some interesting stuff to it, but it is a bit of a misfire for Spike Lee. And he's very talented. It's neat to see him work outside of his comfort zone, but it's by far not his best work. And so I'm going to have to say it kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about In Your Eyes, the box office, and the world-famous DVD roundup.
Because we can, can, can!
Elizabeth Stokes' new romance novel, Five Nights in Vegas, is about meeting, getting married, and falling in love, in that order. Lexi Frost is a cocktail waitress in a Las Vegas casino. Nate Zimmerman is a marketing executive from back east. After a chance meeting on Nate's business trip, they wake up to discover they got married at an all-night wedding chapel. During their whirlwind attempt to undo their mistake, Lexi and Nate discover they might just be made for each other after all. Five Nights in Vegas by Elizabeth Stokes is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr coming in for the final lap of Fat Guys at the Movies. We got one more movie to talk about, and that is In Your Eyes. And it is written by Joss Whedon, and it was apparently written in the early 90s or something like that. And he eventually got the movie made recently, and it premiered at a film festival a year or so ago, and then they self-distributed it, which is kind of cool. And now it's available on Netflix, and I think it comes out on actual physical media, DVD and Blu-ray this week. This was recommended by Ty from St. Louis. If you have a recommendation that you want to send me, send an email to recommend@fatguysatthemovies.com, and I will talk about the movie. If I haven't seen it, I will talk about it on the show. I figured this was worth talking about for Valentine's Day because it's a bit of a love story. In the film, two people who have never met and live on opposite sides of the country discover they are psychically linked when they're able to see and hear what the other does.
Can you hear me?
I can see out there.
This ain't your head, lady. This is New Mexico.
I pretty much thought that you were PMS.
Yeah, a lot of people get us mixed up.
What's with you?
I met someone. So much
time. So when I'm with you, I forget myself.
Couldn't we just...
No, I can't play at this anymore.
The best thing, the only thing about me that I like is you.
This is a unique approach to a romance, and it's very Joss Whedon. If you like Joss Whedon's stuff, and I mean, I'm not even just talking about the writing, because the writing's very Joss Whedon-y, but it seems to be cast with people that you'd see in Joss Whedon's staple. I don't know whether Zoe Kazan has shown up in any of the other stuff that he's done or the guy who plays the lead in this one, but it just feels very Buffy-ish to me, which is, you know, that's not a compliment, that's not a criticism, that's just an observation. It's a sweet little movie. The concept is kind of out there, but it's different, and it's unlike something you're going to see. I mean, we've seen sort of the magical psychic love stories movies that sort of transcend reality, and I always find those neat because it's kind of a neat little what if. And there's a certain intimacy that's in the film, especially with the characters not physically meeting through most of the film, which is kind of cool. I mean, you have this relationship and it's not all that bizarre because, I mean, heck, in today's world with cell phone technology and FaceTime, you could essentially have this kind of relationship without the magical element to it. But the magical element is what makes it fun. It does break down in the middle. It's clear that this is a script that he was writing in his earlier days because it has some trouble in the middle as it gets to from the second act to the third act. And there's some stuff that happens in there that I remember going, I don't know if that's really true. I don't know if that's how it works in terms of factual elements that happen in the back of the film. But, you know, for just a fun little different movie, it's actually pretty good. And it's worth checking out. It's a nice little love story. And like I said, it's got a fantastic element to it. So just not just a love story. You know, you guys out there, if you want to watch it with your significant other and pretend like you're, you know, still macho, you can be like, oh, it's the guy who did the Avengers. Watch this movie. Okay. It's cute. It works. And so thanks to Ty for recommending it. I have to say that In Your Eyes kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys in the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. All right, last week, the box office winner was SpongeBob SquarePants. A lot of people knew that was coming, but nobody was really predicting it was going to make as much as it did. It made $55 million over the weekend. And that's pretty impressive, especially since the first time SpongeBob showed up in theaters was the movie SpongeBob SquarePants, the movie. It made $85 million in its total run, which is good. It had an opening weekend of $32 million. Now, this one had a bit of a 3D bump, and it's 10 years later. But still, $55 million for a show that's 16 years old, that's impressive. And it was a good movie. It's definitely worth checking out. If you have kids, go check it out. It's fun. It's better than just the TV show cartoon. It's not as annoying. So, yeah, I was impressed, and I was kind of happy to see it happen. Yeah, it knocked off American Sniper. It didn't crush American Sniper. And American Sniper's doing fine for itself to have had its first weekend getting knocked off by SpongeBob after making $260-some million. In fact, American Sniper could very well be the highest-grossing domestic film of 2014. The Jupiter Ascending did not do terribly well. It made only $18 million, which is a shame. For me, I liked the movie. I thought it was decent for what it was. I don't know if it's going to do very well overseas, and this might be the end of giant-budgeted movies for the Wachowskis. Although, you know, I think they could make some good, cool, low-budget stuff, too. Seventh Son did even worse. It did $7 million on a $95 million budget, which is pretty pathetic. This week, it's pretty clear that it's going to be 50 Shades of Grey. That is what's going to win the weekend. It is selling like hotcakes. It is selling like hot pants. It is selling like leather whips and chains, chips, dips, chains and whips. Regular old orgy of ticket sales out there. This is going to be huge. I don't think it's going to be Twilight huge. I don't think it's going to be Hunger Games huge. I think it's going to do well. I think it's going to have a huge drop off, though. I think it's going to do half of its money Thursday, Friday. And I don't even think Valentine's Day is going to be the biggest day, being the Saturday. It's most women who want to see it are going to see it Thursday night or Friday. By the end of the weekend, I think it's good for $75 million. And that's enough to justify its sequel and enough to make Jamie Dornan annoyed that he has to shoot more of these movies. Because the guy's a grumpus and doesn't want to make these films. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time for the world-famous DVD roundup. There are some pretty impressive DVDs and Blu-rays this week. The first one I want to hit, there are two movies that I want to hit that are from Disney. The first one is Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day, which is, of course, came out in, I think, September or October of last year. And a lot of people have read the book, the children's book, which is like 12 pages long, and it's very simple. But I thought they did a really good job just sort of adapting a live-action story into it and it's like 78 minutes, 80 minutes or so. It's a pretty short movie, which works, because you don't want to see a 2.5-hour film based on a picture book. And it's cute. I mean, it really is cute. It's for kids, and it's disposable, cool little family fun. It has humor in it that adults will like. It has humor that kids are going to like. I think it's something that a lot of people can enjoy. I was very happy with Alexander the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day, and I am excited that the Blu-ray's out. It's definitely worth checking out with your kids. But even more worth checking out with your kids is 101 Dalmatians, which is my favorite Disney, classic Disney film. I mean, if we're talking sort of like prior to Little Mermaid, it's my favorite Disney film. And it's been out multiple times. It's been out on VHS a couple times. It was out on DVD, I think, back in 2008. I actually had a chance to meet some of the animators at Disney, and I took a little class on how to do ink and paint on cell animation. That was a neat thing, and I got to see the process they used to animate the film, the weird little Xerox machine, which is funny because it takes up, it's like the size of an apartment kitchen where they basically committed this movie to film. And I love 101 Dalmatians. It's a Diamond Edition Blu-ray set. Definitely worth checking out. If you do not have the DVD, or if you want to get the high-def version of 101 Dalmatians, now's your chance. It'll go back in the vault in another year or two, and then you won't be able to get it for a while. So 101 Dalmatians, one of the best Disney films ever. There are also a couple sort of more award-worthy films. You've got Nightcrawler, which is, of course, Jake Gyllenhaal's movie about the unscrupulous videographer who manipulates news events. This is worth seeing, especially for Jake Gyllenhaal's performance. He got a lot of nominations, and it was definitely worth it. Although he didn't get nominated for an Oscar, which is kind of a shame. Also, Rosewater, which isn't a great movie, but it's an okay movie. It's Jon Stewart's directorial debut, and it's about this guy who is an Iranian who was detained in Iran for like almost a year because they thought he was an American spy. And actually, Jon Stewart's The Daily Show was somehow involved in this, so he kind of felt guilty about this. And this is his story. Force Majeure, which is a foreign film about just sort of a family imploding on vacation. Not a great movie. I know a lot of people loved it. I didn't particularly enjoy it, but it's out there. It's worth checking out. Kill the Messenger, which stars Jeremy Renner as the guy who uncovers the CIA's drug trafficking with the Contras back in the 80s and 90s. It's a good start to a movie, but it kind of falls apart at the end. And then finally, the stinker of the week is Laggies, which really isn't that much of a stinker. It's okay. It's Keira Knightley plays a woman who just turns 30 and is trying to get her life under control. Her boyfriend has proposed to her, and she doesn't know what she wants to do with her life. And so she sort of checks out and goes lives with a high school girl that she randomly meets. It's got its moments, but we've seen a lot of this before. And that's it for this week. Next week, we're going to be talking about The Duff, Hot Tub Time Machine 2, McFarland USA, and Wild Tales. In the meantime, think of me when you're trying to replay scenes in your bedroom for 50 Shades of Grey. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.